I want the reader to understand that I am reading this book that was written in third person. Even though I did dictate this book, the author, my dear friend Antoinette May, gives some observations that I will either delete or put in my own feelings about it. Because when somebody is observing you, it's a little bit different than maybe you're writing from your first person. I want to tell you that I had many reasons for writing Adventures of a Psychic, the book that this audio program is based on, but two of my primary goals deserve special attention. First of all, I wanted to give people an understanding of what a psychic truly is all about. Being a psychic has always been a family pattern that includes my grandmother, my dear grandmother, and my mentor, Ada Coyle, an uncle, Henry Caulfield, who was at the time part of the spiritualistic camps that were in Florida, my youngest son who works with me, Christopher Dufresne, and my marvelous granddaughter who showed psychic ability and is even showing it more extreme now that she's six, but really started showing it at three. The genetic aspect is important, but it's not the truest measure of what being psychic really entails. The real issues revolve around our trials and tribulations, our heartaches, our struggles, and the tempering of our souls to make us a vehicle for God. Second, this is a story about a woman, me, one who is perhaps, I sometimes think maybe could this be a crime, that could be too giving, too naive, too understanding, and sometimes too selfless. Yet, this woman is very intelligent, a type of savant almost, as far as people's lives, truth, and spirituality are concerned. I really also want to show that a religious or spiritual person is also very human and not at all saintly, and will experience the same hurts, deception, fears, and phobias as everyone else. I think we have a tendency when someone has a gift to put them on a pedestal. This is cruel to the person, because after all, they have the same feelings as everyone else does. Psychics are really just human beings with a gift, which does not serve us personally very well. I have found as I get older that the gift is not for my benefit in any way, shape, or form, as if it ever was, but I've become to know that even more as I've gotten older. It is something to be given away. If psychics could benefit from that gift, they would simply win the big lotto and never do what they're supposed to do, probably, and that is ultimately to help others. My life reads like a struggle for survival, as do so many other lives. There are loves that went unrequited, challenges met, deception at the hands of friends, and even a husband, and people who hurt me. I think that my story is every man's story. It is also every woman's story. I hope that it is a story of bravery, because I have certainly had to be courageous, strong, and sometimes, in the very bottom of my heart, a very frightened, alone, and sometimes very childlike. Mine is a story of faith, a woman's faith in her God, and also the feminine principle, the goddess. I came here, I know, to herald a first wave of the Gnostic Way, which is the most ancient quest of man searching for truth and his and her own spirituality. Where Novus Spiritus, my spiritual church, goes from here is only known to God. As for me, I will always be helping people, always guiding as God sees fit, and I hope with knowledge, a sense of humor, and compassion. If I must do my work from the back of a goat cart, I will. My contract with God will be fulfilled. As you listen to this audiobook, you will hear a story that's filled with humor. Bear with me in this odyssey. Bear with me in this journey. Understand and try to see beyond just a spoken word to the heart of the woman, the heart of the person, who possibly is too naive, too understanding, and too giving, but certainly has a lot of guts. For all of you who toil in little dark corners, remember me sometimes, this girl from Missouri. I did not necessarily make good, but I certainly gave it my all. I think that God simply wants us to give it our all, give it our best shot. So this is a story of friendship. It's also a love story. It's a story about loyalty, pain, heartache, and challenges. I think it's everyone's story. Would I have changed any of it? I had to think hard on that. But I think not. Someone told me that I was a karmic catharsis for everyone. I guess that seems to fit pretty well. I know that we learn by experiencing and watching how a life unfolds. I hope you enjoy mine and can learn faster than I did. God love you. I do. Chapter 1, People Are Talking. I remember this so well. I was so scared. I was so frightened that I remember sitting there with my nails dug in to my hands and looking for the exit sign and thinking to myself, what would happen if I just got up and bolted? The capacity audience is restless, eager. This isn't just any TV show. These people seek more than entertainment. They want answers. The excitement is really geared up as the lights brighten and the theme music goes on. The studio audience stomps and cheers without prompting as an ambulant host, Ross McGowan, announces. Today we have with us the internationally known psychic, our own Sylvia Brown. I was on People Are Talking for about 10 years, every 2 months. It's kind of a marvelous thing and sort of a sweet thing that people start doing this ownership. And that's where it comes from, our own Sylvia Brown. The rotating stage moves on cue, stopping with a sudden jerk to reveal me. A Rubenesque woman with warm brown eyes. There is a burst of spontaneous applause. In the trade, I've been told that I'm known as good TV because the ratings invariably zoom when I appear. Now that I've gotten more TV savvy, they call me just the rating booster. Ann Fraser, the short, attractive, blonde co-host, steps forward, scanning the excited audience. She asks, is there anyone here who doesn't believe in psychics? A tall, dark-haired man raises his hand defiantly. I say, there's some kind of dairy farm that you'll be going into. You have 2 sons, but are raising 2 other boys as well. My smile broadens at the familiar look of astonishment. Then I add, you should check the transmission on your car and see a doctor about the left knee. The man stares at me, surprise and confusion apparent on his face. And so it goes for voyeurs at home, as well as for the studio audience. People wave wildly for the microphone, eager to discuss their tangled love lives, their rare diseases, their finances, their neurotic families. Even skeptics, or I should say, skeptics prior to this, seem eager to ask me questions. The audience oohs and ahs as the TV show continues. But this is easy stuff. The information I divulge can be verified instantly. The real work comes when I go into the future, precognitively, and talk about things that are beyond present awareness. The subjects shake their heads doubtfully. Me, another baby, I'll be 45 in December. No way. Or, you're going to move to Minnesota. You've got to be kidding. It doesn't matter how good the job was. The verification will come later. Sometimes much later. I always seem to receive a call and be told, remember me, I was the one who said, ... Well, I just wanted to tell you, ... that I did have it happen. I did have a baby boy when I was 46, and I did move to Minnesota. The job was just too good to pass up. The local CBS TV show is aptly named People Are Talking. People are talking about me, but more precisely, they come to talk about themselves, which is only right. Their hopes, their fears, sometimes even their secrets. It's not new. The question asked of me, a modern seer, are identical to those placed before the Delphic oracles thousands of years ago. Only the delivery system has changed. My manner seems to be frequently flipped, funny, often suggestive of a stand-up comic, but underlying it, trust me when I tell you, is all the warmth and compassion that draws skeptics and believers alike. I always speak in specifics and shoot from the hip. I don't like any of that psychic, esoteric jargon. Now looking about the studio, I spot a woman sitting on the aisle near the back. You're very concerned, aren't you, about something that may even approach blackmail? Don't pay it. None of what happens is as it appears to you now. He's playing on your fears. Call him on it, and he'll drop the whole business. The woman's face brightens. Her relief is obvious. Oh, thank you, she murmurs. I don't have to validate this for the viewing audience. It's me now talking to that woman one-on-one. She doesn't have to verify me. It's enough that she knows that I know, that I can tell her truly that everything is going to be all right. These are the happy, easy answers. The more traumatic ones are harder to deal with, especially on television. Often the messages I deliver are carefully couched. I see 2 pregnancies this year. I tell a young woman who hopes to conceive a child, don't feel bad about the first. The second will be a girl, born early next spring. The word miscarriage isn't used. I won't use it. The woman understands. But other times I am more direct. The new red sports car you're so crazy about, get rid of it right away, I warn a glitzy brunette. Why? She looks at me with big batting eyes. Because you're going to crash if you don't get rid of it. Eventually there are questions about me. It sounds like you believe in reincarnation, a man ventures. I don't believe, I answer, I know. God's an equal opportunity employer. Do you think he'd give us just one chance to be stupid, dumb, ugly, fat, thin, whatever we're going to be? How long have you felt this way? He asks. Always, I guess. When I was 3, I'd insist that my father taste my food first. They'd tell me. I'd sit very patiently watching him chew, waiting, I guess, for him to drop dead. When nothing happened, I'd dive in and eat. I've always had quite an appetite, as people who see me can realize. It must have been hard for me to wait, but I did. Apparently, I had a strong memory of being poisoned in a past life and wasn't about to make that mistake again. Maybe I sensed even then that I had a lot to accomplish this time around. Most children are born with past life recall. I really believe this with all my heart, but they can't pass on the information available to them for lack of vocabulary. Impatient or skeptical parents not meaning to compound the problem. So unfortunately, much valuable information is lost forever because as we grow older, we tend to forget. What's it like to be a psychic? A young man calls from the back of the studio. What's it like not to be a psychic? I ask, shrugging. What about your spirit guide? Someone asks. The questioner is a scholarly-looking woman in a far corner. What about Francine? Even the regulars lean forward expectantly. For them, it's a familiar but still fascinating story. I was 7 when Francine first appeared to me, I explain. I can't remember when I didn't hear messages that others couldn't. But they were always far off in the background, always like a soft whisper that could be ignored. Francine was something else entirely. One night, I was in my bedroom, playing with a flashlight, because I've always had this problem with insomnia, when suddenly I saw this Indian. Now I look back and say that I realize that she almost had an Aztec flavoring to her. Beautiful, tall, with a black braid. Don't be afraid, Sylvia, she said, I come from God. Don't be afraid. She was as close as real as I look at Anne Fraser. I insist, pointing the woman sitting beside me. And there she was standing right in front of the middle of my bedroom. I jumped up and ran out screaming. Fortunately, there really is such a thing as fortune or chance. My psychic grandmother was staying with us. She was very ho-hum about it all. And that was very reassuring to me. She explained that we all have spirit guides who are assigned to us to be helpers. The only difference was that she and I could see ours, and everybody in my genetic strain of the family could hear theirs. My guide is a South American Indian whose name is really Aina. That was a little too bizarre for a 7-year-old, I remember. I liked the name Francine, So that's what I rechristened my new friend. I think I couldn't say the name Iena that well. So I think I had a friend by the name of Francine, so I tacked that onto it. She didn't mind. In fact, she seemed to know exactly the sort of things that would appeal to me. I lost my fear of her completely when she taught me how to play What Are They Saying Downstairs? You can imagine the stir that game created, but it was a nice stir. Francine, like Grandma, was and is the quintessence of psychic etiquette. In the beginning, she seemed very old to me. She was about 30, and there she remains. As I get older, she stays younger, which is enough to tick anybody off. Ross McGowan asked a question for the audience. Don't you sometimes feel that what you tell people robs them of their free will, he inquires. I shake my head. Absolutely not. If I get it, you're supposed to know it. I believe that what I receive comes from God, just as Francine told me long ago. I laugh good-naturedly. I hate to think it was coming from me. But I also know that you cannot control anyone who wants to do something. You can't interfere with their chart. You can help them, you can aid them, but you can't control them. How many times have those of you out there listening to me would like to say, God, I'd give anything to be able to control my son from not drinking, my husband from not gambling, but you can't. You can try to help them. You can be the step up to the plate person. But you can't help them if they don't want to. I believe that specifics are essential. That's what mediumship is all about. I wouldn't be a professional if I told people all that Mickey Mouse stuff about going from darkness into light. Anybody can say something like that. And what good does that do? You can't help someone without giving specific information. Francine's comes through when I'm in the trance state and tell people about their soul work and their mission in life, and their themes, and their patterns, and their options. I stay with my feet fully planted on this earth. I stay with the now, and the gritty, lousy, sometimes soap opera of life. I am able to tune into the blueprint within each of my clients. You know what I've thought recently? I began to go over this again. It's almost like you hand me your paper, your chart. You are farsighted, I'm nearsighted. And you hand me your page to read, and I read it to you. That's about the best way I can describe what a blueprint is about. Although I prefer to do one-on-one predictions, I acquired a national reputation for general interest forecasts. It's really no different, I tell the audience. I just sit down and ask myself questions. What about the economy? What about the president's health? What about earthquakes? What about, what about, what about? But how do you do it? Ann Fraser asks. I don't know. I really don't. I just open myself up and it comes. I don't analyze. Like once I told a woman that she was going to start a worm farm. Yes, a worm farm. If I'd thought about that, I wouldn't have said it. But I just didn't think. I just opened my mouth and out it came. Exactly what I was receiving from God. It's sort of like you're a tube by which you say, hit it, God, and it just comes through. The woman wasn't surprised at all. Yeah, she said, I always thought that would be an interesting way to make a living. An older man rises to ask one last question. What about you, Sylvia? What's your future? I shake my head. My blonde hair gleaming under the TV lights. Now, this is Antoinette's, observation of me. I say, I never know. The gift isn't meant for the medium herself. If I weren't doing the right thing, it would all shut down. People ask me if I ever get bored answering the same old questions. The answer is no. I certainly don't. I've always said to each one of my clients, if it's important to you, it's important to me. People are funny, though. Once I told a man he'd be starting a new job on April 5th, and he called me indignantly to tell me that I was all wrong. It started April 6th. Another funny story happened just recently. I had told a woman about a year ago that she would meet and marry a Richard. She called me all irate and said, you were absolutely wrong, Sylvia. His name is Dick. One of these days, I'm going to write a book about what people say to me. But don't you ever see anything for yourself? The questioner persists. Very rarely, I tell her firmly. But I'm glad it's that way. For an instant, my face clouds as my thoughts turn unbidden to a tragic love affair long ago. There had been a slight warning. Ross signals, it's commercial time. A brief wind-up and the show is over. I'm smiling again at the audience as a revolving stage moves me backward into the shadows. And that's what my life has been a lot about. Shadows and light, and shadows and light, and sorrow and happiness. But isn't that the tale of every man? I, Sylvia Celeste Shoemaker, was born October 19th, 1936, Kansas City, Missouri, at 2 p.m. straight up. My arrival was like that of any other baby, except that I was born with a cowl. It is spelled C-A-U-L, and it is a membrane that fits over the child's face. When wrapped about the head of a newborn infant, a cowl, the inner fetal membrane, has for centuries signified the birth of a child with second sight. That inner seeing, inner knowing that distinguishes the psychic from all others. Bill Shoemaker, my beloved father, who has now passed, since this book has been written, who attended the birth, already had a psychic mother-in-law to contend with. Now here was another psychic in the family. When the cowl was removed, yet another mystical portent was revealed. On my forehead, centered just above my two great brown eyes, was a tiny drop of blood. It looked for all the world like a mysterious third eye, the all-seeing orb of the prophet. I've come to believe that everyone is psychic, but most people remain unaware of their own extrasensory abilities. It's possible that the presence of a cowl may be a reminder to those whose lives will require a greater use of their gift. For me, the ancient sign was prophetic. I've really never known what it was like not to be a psychic. That's why it's so hard for me to answer the question, what is it like to be psychic? I have to say, it's just me. The signs appeared very early. It would seem that I had been prepared for the extraordinary path ahead. I knew who was at the door before the guests even knocked. Then when I was 3, my paternal grandfather died suddenly of a heart attack. My father learned of the tragedy at work and came home to inform my mother, Celeste. I was standing in the doorway when he entered. Grandpa's dead, I announced, before my dad had uttered a word. A far happier pronouncement was my prediction that a baby sister was joining us. She'll come in 3 years, when I'm 6, I said. Sharon arrived 1 month short of my 6th birthday. I hear these stories told and retold at family gatherings, but can only smile at the continuing sense of marvel. What did they expect of a child building psychic muscle? An even more important event occurred when I was 4. Early one morning, hearing my postman father depart for his early morning mail route, I trotted into my parents' room and climbed into bed beside my mother. Suddenly, as I turned over and glanced randomly at the ceiling, it burst open before my eyes. High above me was a glorious sunrise with streaks of cerise, gold, hot pink, and purple against the somber dawn. Soaring across this grand panorama was a flock of wild birds in a V formation. A voice spoke with such great clarity. Sylvia, you will never be as free as the birds that you see. Did you hear that? I asked my mother in astonishment. What happened to the ceiling? Did you see those birds? My mother, Celeste Shoemaker, had seen nothing. As a daughter of a medium, she'd grown up in a home where visions were commonplace. Although not psychic herself, paranormal phenomena were nothing new to her. My mother's attitude toward my growing, in quote, strangeness, was one of mild annoyance. She didn't welcome more eccentricity in her life and would do nothing to encourage it in me. The ceiling looked exactly as it always had, my mother assured me, and she attempted to divert my attention with talk of breakfast. But I never, ever forgot the experience. In later years, recalling the free-flowing momentum of the birds, the full realization of the message was revealed to me. The word freedom has many meanings to as many people, but psychics are the first to agree that they themselves have very little freedom indeed. I believe that people chose to be psychic, must share their gift, at whatever cost to their own comfort or peace of mind. For some, perhaps, lifelong dedication comes easy, but for me, it is not. The suffering has often been intense, particularly when the gift has come into open conflict with my own desires. The unwanted knowing began when I was 5. The family was assembled for a Sunday gathering. I was seated beside my father, listening half-heartedly to the adult chatter, glancing absently at the great-grandmother Hattie, who was seated across from me. I was horrified all of a sudden to see that her face began to slowly melt. Her features were running like wax, slowly oozing downward until there was no face, only a skull. Screaming in terror, I turned only to confront the face of my other great-grandmother, Sarah. It, too, appeared to be melting, not as rapidly, but melting nevertheless. Frantically, I pulled at my father's arm, begging him to take me home. Outside, I attempted to explain to him the frightful thing that I just witnessed. "Daddy," I said, "I saw their faces running." I was sobbing then. He would not, could not understand me. Within 10 days, Hattie Braun was dead. 4 days later, Sarah Shoemaker's death followed. I began to see other melting faces, and each vision was invariably followed by death. My fear and confusion led to feelings of guilt. Was I in some way responsible? I was miserable. Again and again, I tried to explain what I was experiencing. My father, Bill Shoemaker, was ambitious, determined to get ahead in the world. He was also a charmer who found little difficulty balancing a philandering nature with conventional family responsibilities. My mother, Celeste, was challenged by a Don Juan husband, 7 years her junior, but she was determined to wait it out. "One day, Daddy will grow up," she often sighed. In the meantime, her method of dealing with problems was to pretend they didn't exist. I would vividly recall my mother's response to anything remotely threatening. She simply excused herself, slipped off to have a long soak in the bathtub. It was a family signal that she insulated herself from reality and was not ever, ever to be disturbed. During those traumatic days of melting faces, my mother, I think, took many baths while my father indulged himself with a passing parade of pretty ladies. Then one day my maternal grandmother, Ada Coyle, came to call. Seating herself beside me, a frightened child who was daily growing more and more withdrawn, she pulled me, now sobbing, into her lap and comforted me. When the tears had subsided, Grandma Coyle began to question me gently with great care. Once again, I attempted to describe what I'd seen, the running, oozing faces, slipping slowly downward until nothing remained but a skull. "Am I killing them, Grandma?" I asked, my voice little more than a whisper. "No, dear, it's their time to go. You have nothing to do with it," the older woman assured me. "Then it is real?" "Very real," she said. "Do you see the melting faces too?" I asked, leaning forward. "Not the faces, but other things. I see things that others don't, just as you do. It's because we're psychic." The 5-year-old didn't want to be psychic. It wasn't fun at all. Patiently, Ada explained that the gift of sight was ours, want it or not. It was a kind of trust from God to be used for the benefit of others. "But I don't want to see melting faces. I'm afraid of skulls," I said, beginning to cry again. "Then ask God not to show them to you," Grandma advised. "What you can't handle, pray to be relieved of." I did a lot of praying, and the hideous visions have never returned. I do know, though, when someone is going to die, and I don't foist that information upon them, but I just, like everything else in the chart, I do know when their contract with God is up. The Shoemaker family was divided. My father was a Jew, my mother an Episcopalian. Harmony was not the most notable household characteristic. Something had to be done about me. I clearly needed stability and guidance. Ultimately, the idea of a convent emerged as a perfect solution. So, at my grandmother's urging, the Shoemakers became a Catholic family marching down the aisle to be baptized together. And that's exactly what happened. I adapted quickly to Catholic teaching. I was particularly impressed by the nuns and strove to emulate them. Soon there was a makeshift altar in my bedroom, and for days at a time, I insisted on wearing a long black dress with a white tea towel pinned to it. No one was surprised when I announced that I wanted to be a nun. Like Grandma Ada, the nuns appeared to me as islands of strength and clarity in a world that was becoming more and more complex for me. Bright, eager both to learn and to please, I found that school was easy, although other things were not. My increasing psychic abilities were a burden for which I could never free myself, separating me from friends and parents alike. More than anything else in this world, I really wanted to be normal, whatever that means. I had begun to see inside my head, frequently experiencing an eerie montage of spirits and mortals, two distinct vibrations going on simultaneously. Often I would ask people, anyone who happened to be near, did you see that? Did you hear that? The answer was always no. However, sometimes these strange feelings seemed more like gifts than burdens. Once while attending a movie with my father, I suddenly began to hyperventilate. Both my father and I were enjoying the comedy immensely. And the 7-year-old tried to overcome the sensation, but its intensity only increased. A sick dizziness swept over me. The panic was overwhelming. Am I dying? I thought wildly. No, a voice inside replied. It is someone else near to you. Frantically, the frightened me tried to remain calm, tried to resist the waves of sickening panic. Where is this coming from? I kept asking myself. Seemingly in answer, a picture flashed before my mind's eye, clear and bold as the one on the screen. My baby sister gasping for air. We've got to go, I whispered to my father. There's something terrible. Something is terribly the matter with Sharon. She can't breathe. She's turning blue. That's ridiculous, he chided me. We just left Sharon an hour ago. She's fine. But desperately now frightened, I persisted. Sharon's life depended on my father believing me. Daddy, please, we have to go now. I ended now on a high-pitched scream. You better know what you're talking about, my father snapped, as the two of us picked our way between the seats of a darkened theater, stumbling over the feet of the annoyed spectators around us. The ride home was agony for me, as if I was now experiencing all of Sharon's symptoms. Hurry, Daddy, please hurry, I pleaded. My lungs seemed to be bursting with the effort to breathe. Certain that my sister must be dying, I gasped frantically for air. It seemed that an eternity had passed until at last I saw my house in the distance. As our car turned in the drive, my mother ran out sobbing. The phone was out of order. Sharon had become desperately ill with what turned out to be double pneumonia. My father was just in time to rush my baby sister to the hospital. Grateful as my parents were for this apparent miracle, it was obscured by my eccentricity, which my mother and father saw increasing every day. I wasn't an easy child for them to understand. Their lives were complicated enough without the aberration of this strange little creature who turned in psychically to every family secret and insisted on pointing out ghosts. My double vision was really becoming a nuisance. The otherworldly dimension that had crept unbidden into our life was a nightmare distraction. It's like a prey to people walking back and forth in my room, I attempted to explain. Give her a flashlight, Grandma Coyle explained and advised. She said, when it's dark, because spirits almost come as energy, it creates an infrared impression, and Sylvia will see them. So if you put light on, it dispenses them. To this day, at 62 years of age, I still sleep with a nightlight in the hall. Not because I'm afraid anymore, no. It's just because I don't want to see the parade of all the people that are occupying the same dimension. One night, a few months after the incident of Sharon's illness, I was shining the light around the wall. Suddenly, it began to expand until it filled the entire room. Out of nowhere, a tall, dark woman appeared. She smiled and said, "Dear Sylvia, don't be afraid. I come from God." The words signaled yet another psychic gift. At 8, I had become clairaudient. Now, besides seeing things that others didn't see, I heard voices they didn't hear. It's true that, as in the vision of the free-flying birds, there had been auditory sensation, almost like whispered thoughts. But these words were spoken clearly and directly into my ears. Don't be afraid indeed. I fled, shrieking, from the room. My grandmother, Ada Coyle, put her arms around me as I screamed. It's just a bad dream, she explained to my parents, who regarded me with bewilderment. Gently, she led me up the stairs to the guest room. Between the sobs, it gradually turned to hiccups. I explained what had happened. Oh, is that all? I've heard voices all my life, Grandma Ada assured me. You just made contact with your spirit guide. It's really someone like a guardian angel, a person who's there to help you. You can be happy, not frightened. Most people never get to hear their guides, never get to meet their guides, even though they're always there. Dear grandmother, the pillar of my life, of my entire world, if she heard voices, perhaps it was okay. I stopped crying and began to listen. The appearance of a spirit guide was the beginning of what was to become the strongest, most enduring relationship of my whole life. Yet in those early days, the friendship was an uneasy one. Often when the now familiar buzz and high-pitched whine started signaling the beginning of a message, I would panic, almost paralyzed by terror. At the same time, being a child, I was filled with curiosity and a sense of destiny. Iena, my guide, took a lot of getting used to. The name alone was a bit off-putting, as we say. At the time, Francine was my favorite name. So that's what I rechristened my new companion. Lots of children have made up friends, my parents, still resisting, reminded one another in the beginning. But as time passed and Francine's predictions imparted to them by me became true, they ruefully began to revise their options and their opinions. I saw no conflict between Francine's ever-increasing presence and the teaching of the nuns. Weren't they forever talking of guardian angels and messages from God? Maybe I wasn't so different after all. The thought brought me some relief from my family's accelerated chaos. During a brief period of unity, my parents begged and borrowed their way into possession of a 3-story Victorian mansion. The purchase was meant as a promise of a future affluence and solidarity. The solidarity, however, was never to materialize. After enduring the many moves linked with my father's financial successes and his amorous weakness, I perceived the new house as a bastion of hope and safety. I loved it and knew in my heart that the house loved me as well. Running from room to room, I took a delighted inventory, an impressive entry with large walnut pillars and graceful stairway, an inviting living room accentuated by tile fireplace, an elegant dining room with stained glass windows, a large homey kitchen, and butler's pantry. 4 large bedrooms, and finally the promising mystery of an attic to explore. So we all moved in, including Grandma Ada. Delightful as the house was, the family scene wasn't enough for my father, or perhaps it was too much. Whatever the cause, it wasn't long after the move that he became involved in yet another romance, this one more significant. A compromise was reached. My father would remain married while settling his mistress into a comfortable apartment conveniently located 6 blocks from home. Despite all the distractions, he remained, though, a very devoted father. He doted on me, but set high standards. "Show them what you can do," was his favorite refrain. Fearful that I, like my mother, might lose the attention of this marvelous man, I determined not to disappoint him. What if some random act on my part inadvertently drove my father away forever? I must never do anything to cause dissension, I thought. It's my duty to please everyone. The responsibility was overwhelming. Sad as it sounds now, I realized that that was the forecast of what my life would be, though. And I was trained, I guess, at a very early age to please and to perform. And it's like everything else I always say, you can turn a negative into a positive. Use it for good use. My whole life became one of performance, of dedication. I was determined to please, to entertain, to soothe, to make well. My efforts and the self-discipline I had to learn served as a kind of conditioning. It was as though I was a young athlete training for the big meet. Late one night, while lying sleepless, I was startled by the vision of 2 masks superimposed on the wall before me. It was a classical Greek comedy and tragedy masks. Their significance was explained by Francine, who told me, "Sylvia, this is your life." And it has been, as most lives are. the mask of comedy and tragedy. The only thing is, you don't want the mask of tragedy to take over. You really want the comedic mask to be the one that faces the world, inside as well as out. The words were prophetic. Death and its many implications, reincarnation, mediumship, documentation of soul survival, play a daily part of my life. And so does comedy. Anyone who's ever watched me on stage or television has witnessed a comedian at work. Humor is a spoonful of sugar that enables me to laugh at the dark mysteries of life and death. Without it and its comedic glory, I or any other psychic would lack humanity and possibly even humility. As time passed, Francine made herself increasingly visible. She's an imposing figure, an Indian woman standing about 5'9", slender with long black hair and brown, perfectly almond-shaped eyes. She speaks simply and precisely, conveying much in just a few words. Her message has always been one of tolerance, compassion, and forgiveness. Her direct approach, both modest and practical. In the beginning, she talked with me about things a child would respond to. At first, I was primarily interested in games. It was amusing to me to repeat to the family the conversations that I couldn't possibly have overheard. The surprise reaction was instant validation, and it further reinforced my confidence. As our friendship grew, I asked Francine a lot of questions about her and her past relationship with me. Iena, / Francine, had been born in northern Colombia in the year 1500. That was, Francine told me, her one and only life on earth. Though she has had but one goal, to help people, she had no wish to return to the world as a mortal. From 1520 until my birth in 1936, Francine was training to become a communicating guide. That, of course, is one that talks through the medium. Francine and I first met shortly before I went down the tunnel into the fetus. There were two different personalities sharing one very important mission. Despite my powers, I had no memory of any of this. It was necessary for Francine to explain it in a manner that a child could understand. There's nothing mysterious about a spirit guide. It is also, I want to say here, it is not a higher self. It's not a split of your alter ego. It is a distinct and definite personality unto itself, a separate entity. Francine told me a guide is very much like a human, except that he or she resides on the other side, in a perfect state of, let's say, glorified body. The guide's job is to help a given individual through the present incarnation that they're in. Most everyone on earth has been or will be a spirit guide for someone. A side note here, I hope to God that when I go over, she does have another life and I can be her spirit guide. I say this with humor and somewhat of a sardonic twist to it. The spirit guide's purpose is to research, suggest, nudge, and encourage the person whom he or she may be guiding through life. In most cases, the guides operate in the individual's subconscious, appearing as a voice of conscience. That's that quiet voice inside of all of us. They will illustrate lessons and speak of what the individual is here to learn, but they will never interfere with your choices. They are extremely careful never to preclude the opportunity for a person to learn a life lesson. If the subject is headed toward an event that will teach a valuable but difficult lesson, a guide may point out an alternative route. The decision remains with the individual. If that choice involves pain and struggle, the guide won't prevent it and can't prevent it. They can help you through it, though. They can soothe it. They can give you reasons why you spiritually went through it. Let's be realistic. If everything was perfect, we shouldn't be here. According to Francine, spirit guides may use a variety of methods to communicate. They convey knowledge through dreams or as a flash in the mind's eye, even occasionally as a voice calling your name. It's a frustrating task, Francine told me, because few people take the time to really listen. As I was growing up, Francine was a constant advisor and companion, slowly and carefully imparting the wisdom that would become my philosophy as a medium. Someday you will be a great psychic, Francine informed me. You will help many people and will be asked to speak before large groups of people. I was anything but pleased by this prospect. Seeking comfort from my grandmother, I pleaded, I don't have to do this if I don't want to do it. Grandma, do I have to? I don't have to if I don't want to, I kept saying. I'll have stage fright, I remember thinking. Grandma aided, patted me reassuringly. Of course not. But when the time comes and you're ready, you'll be able to do it. So this shy little girl would grow up into an audacious, spirited woman. The time would soon come when I would seek a life of my own. Chapter 3. A Psychic in Love. My eyes fill with tears when I think of my long-ago first marriage when I was very young. I was 16 when my father announced that he at last met the woman he couldn't live without. Stormy threats of divorce, tearful attempts at reconciliation were all I'd ever known from my parents. Now Celeste and Bill really had something to quarrel over, their children.